Today we celebrate Shakyamuni Buddha's unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening. The portrait of Shakyamuni Buddha on the altar is the traditional image used throughout Japan for this ceremony for Rohatsu, for Buddha's realizing the way celebration. It's a famous old Chinese painting called Shakyamuni Descending the Mountain. And I just think that it's wonderful that for the, we might say, the greatest Buddhist holy day, Shakyamuni Buddha's great enlightenment, one might think that the image of the Buddha to which we make offerings would be the most radiant, glowing, light beam radiating, exalted, cosmic Buddha we could imagine. But in the Zen tradition, the image for such a celebration is this unshaved, ragged, poor, shabby monk at the end of his long sesshin, after having realized the way, descending the mountain, coming down from his great realization back into the world, the ordinary world of shabby humans, to help out. Disguising his Buddha nature in the form of an ordinary human. And if you look closely at the painting, his hands kind of concealed in the robe. It's a hidden mudra. And these paintings and statues of Buddha descending the mountain always have that image of like a fist hidden in the robe sleeve. So, although he looks like an ordinary, shabby human, we could say that's the secret Buddha mind mudra, secretly hidden under the robe, so we can't see what it is. But he's bringing that back into the world. And this calligraphy was hanging in my room, and I was looking at it. What is that? And reading it, it says, "What is the meaning of Buddha nature?" This was done by my teacher, Tenzin Roshi. What is the meaning of Buddha nature? That's our question for today. That's our answer for today.
Doctor, could you tell us what characters are?
So, it's something like, like what this, kind of like that. So it's more like the question. That makes it a question. Like what this Buddha nature meaning. Maybe literally, like what this Buddha nature meaning. But this is from case 72 in the Book of Serenity, where it's translated as, what is the meaning of Buddha nature? a monk asked Zhongyi, and he said, well, it's like if you put a monkey in a house with six windows. Six windows. An eye consciousness window, an ear consciousness window, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness window. Through these windows, the world comes in. And inside the house, there's a monkey, and when you call it through any one of the windows, it responds. But that's not our story for today. By popular request, we have the story of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment. Of course, there's many versions. This is this year. I'll share the version. Even there might be several versions even within the Pali Canon, the old way, the Theravada tradition. The ancient way. Maybe most, you know, all Buddhist schools honor these early teachings as authentic teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, and they might be most close to what really went down in those old days. This is a collection from a few different stories, three different sutras, Pali sutras. So, at one point, the Buddha, and they're all, you know, the Buddha teaching, basically. So, the Buddha's saying, kind of in verse here, as I strove to subdue myself beside the broad Naranjara River, which, still flows through the town of Bodh Gaya. Absorbed unflinchingly to gain the true cessation of bondage here, in his days of striving under the Bodhi tree in his great sesshin, Mara came and spoke to me with words all garbed in pity thus, oh, you are thin and you are pale, and you are in death's presence too, starving yourself there. Gotama, 1,000 parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part for you. You like almost have given yourself away to death, but you have a little bit left in your life. Live, sir, life is the better way. You can gain merit if you live. Come, live the holy life and pour libations on the holy fires, and thus a world of merit gain. Which, referring to the Indian tradition of the Brahmins making ceremonial offerings to gain merit, and therefore have a happy rebirth. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling too is rough and difficult and hard to bear. Kind of interesting that Mara says not so much like just forget your whole practice, but like practice, but like find an easier way to just like accumulate merit. And you know, doing these ceremonies is not so painful as zazen after zazen after zazen. So let's do some ceremonies. The path of struggling is rough and difficult and hard to bear. Now Mara, as he spoke these lines, drew near until he stood close by. The Blessed One replied to him as he stood thus, O evil one, O cousin of the negligent, You have come here for your own ends. Now merit I need not at all. Let Mara talk of merit then to those that stand in need of it. And, you know, we do honor in the Buddhist path the accumulation of merit, as I mentioned the other day. But at this point in the Buddhist path, he had accumulated the necessary requisite quantity of merit. let Mara talk of merit then to those that stand in need of it, for I have faith and energy and I have understanding too. So while I thus subdue myself, why do you speak to me of life? There is this wind that blows can dry even the river's running streams. So while I thus subdue myself, why should it not dry up my blood? And as the blood dries up, then bile and phlegm run dry. The wasting flesh becalms the mind. I shall have more of mindfulness, of understanding. I shall have greater concentration. It's kind of like, let my very blood dry up here. I'm not going to be moved from this determination. For living thus, I come to know the limits to which feeling goes. My mind looks not to sense desires. You see a being's purity. And now he's going to tell Mara of, I think it's Mara's 12 armies. This is in the Sutta Nipata. Mara's 12 armies, squadrons. Your first squadron is sense desires. Your second is called boredom. Then hunger and thirst compose the third, and craving is the fourth in rank. The fifth is sloth and laziness, while cowardice lines up as sixth. Uncertainty or doubt is seventh, and eighth is malice paired with obstinacy. Gain, honor, and renown besides, and ill-won notoriety, self-praise and denigrating others. These are your squadrons, your armies, Mara. These are the black ones fighting squadrons. None but the brave will conquer them to gain bliss by the victory. I fly the ribbon that denies retreat. I will not turn back. Shame on life here, I say. Better I die in battle now than choose to live on in defeat. There are shramanas and brahmins that have surrendered here, and they are seen no more. They do not know the paths the pilgrim travels by. So, seeing Mara's squadrons now arrayed all round with elephants, I sally forth to fight that I may not be driven from my post. You serried squadrons which the world with all its gods cannot defeat, I shall now break with understanding as with a stone, a raw clay pot. Buddha's poetic verses. Going into battle, the battle cry. We're going to meet Mara with understanding. And the Mahayana sutras have many pages of colorful descriptions of the wild attacks of Mara in all forms, to try to shake the Buddha from his seat. Now we move to another sutra here. Still under the, you know, at this time of practice by the Naranjara River, the Buddha thought, I thought whenever a monk or Brahmin has felt in the past or will feel in the future or feels now painful, racking, piercing feeling due to striving, it can equal this but not exceed it. In other words, no one's painful struggle has been greater than mine. But by this grueling penance, I have attained no distinction higher than the human state, worthy of the Noble One's knowledge and vision. Might there be another way to enlightenment than this painful, racking, piercing feelings due to striving? And I thought of a time when my Shakyan father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome things. I entered upon and abode in the first meditation, the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained focus, keeping the object, the mind tied to the object, applying it to the object and sustaining it on the object. The first jhana, the first meditation, accompanied by this applied and sustained attention, with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. I thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? Then following up that memory, there came the recognition that this was the way to enlightenment. This kind of very settled meditation, as opposed to this forced, extremely painful struggle. Then I thought, and it that meditation comes with pleasure, physical and mental blissful joy accompanied the first jhana. I thought, why am I afraid of such pleasure? It's pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual desires and unwholesome things. Then I thought, I'm not afraid of such pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sense desires and unwholesome things. Well, you know, most people tend to be a little bit more afraid of pain, but the Bodhisattva here is much more afraid of pleasure. Pain wasn't so pleasant, but that was not so dangerous. I thought, is it possible to attain that pleasure of this meditation with a body so excessively emaciated? Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and bread. Now at that time, the five monks that were attending on me, thinking, if the monk Gotama achieves something, he will tell us. As soon as I ate the solid food, the boiled rice and bread, the five monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the monk Gotama has become self-indulgent. He's given up the struggle and reverted to luxury. Now when I had eaten solid food and had regained strength, then quite secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon an abode in the first meditation, the first dhyana, the first zen in Japanese, which is accompanied by applied and sustained attention, with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. With the stilling of applied and sustained attention, I entered upon an abode in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained attention, but with happiness and pleasure born of concentration. It's a little exposition on the four jhanas. You start with applied and sustained attention to the object, and as you go deeper, you no longer have to apply the mind to the object. But there's still this physical and mental happiness and bliss. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. With the fading as well of happiness, I abode in onlooking equanimity, mindful and fully aware. So first the mental blissful happiness is to you know, a little too disturbing, so that drops away. But there's still the still feeling pleasure in the body. I entered upon an abode in the third jhana, referring to which the noble ones announce, one has a pleasant abiding who looks on with equanimity and is mindful. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. With abandoning of bodily pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of mental joy and grief, so there's like no happiness or unhappiness, no pleasure or pain as this meditation goes deeper and deeper. I entered upon an abode in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and the purity of whose mindfulness is due to onlooking equanimity, but I allowed no such pleasure as arose in me. She already says there isn't any. So it doesn't gain power over his mind. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, and rid of imperfection, when it had become malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. So this is said to be the purpose, actually, of these four jhanas, is not so much the bliss or the equanimity that arises from them, but to make the mind very flexible, buoyant, and wieldy, able to, like, really investigate what's going on here now. It's just a mind training, pretty intense mind training, but now we can really look into the nature of things. The mind purified, bright, unblemished, malleable, wieldy, steady, I directed and inclined my mind to the knowledge of recollection of past lives. These are the three knowledges in the Buddha's night of the Buddha's enlightenment. And I always find myself ending up in these discussions with people about the Buddha didn't teach rebirth, but this is like the kind of classic sutra of the Buddha's description of his enlightenment, and that's what he first started looking at, rebirth. To the knowledge of recollection of past lives, I recollected my manifold past lives, that's to say, one birth, two, three, four, five births, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births. This is all on one night. Maybe one moment even, with this kind of, you know, very steady, concentrated mind. Many ages of world contraction, maybe many ages of world expansion, many ages of world contraction and expansion. I was there so named, of such a race, with such an appearance, such food, such experience of pleasure and pain, such a life term. It's pretty specific, right? It's like, I remember these particular lives, I even have this name, and this is what I ate in that past life. And passing away thence, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a race, with such an appearance, such an experience of pleasure and pain, such a life term. Passing away thence, I reappeared here. Thus, with details and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. Of course, there's no self, abiding self, going through any of this. It's not really my past lives, but it's cause and effect playing out and back to the endless, beginningless past. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed, I inclined my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human eye, I saw beings passing away and reappearing. So now it's not his own kind of lineage of past lives, but all kinds of many beings arising and passing away. Inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations, I understood how beings pass on according to their karma, their actions. These worthy beings who were ill conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in view, giving effect to wrong view in their actions on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in states of suffering in an unhappy destination, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well, had good conduct in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of the noble ones, with right view, giving effect to right view in their actions on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a happy destination, even in the heavenly realms. Thus, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human eye, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, and so on, according to their karma. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the second watch of the night. So second true knowledge is particularly about the workings of karma. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed and inclined my mind to the knowledge of exhaustion of outflows, the ashravas, the way that Buddha nature flows out and is lost. I had direct knowledge as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I had direct knowledge as it actually is, that these are the outflows. This is the origin of the outflows. This is the cessation of the outflows, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of outflows. Knowing thus and seeing thus, my heart was liberated from the outflow of sense desire, from the outflow of becoming, and from the outflow of ignorance. These are the three outflows he was liberated from. When liberated, there came the knowledge. It's liberated. Dogen says, Buddhas do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas, but Shakyamuni Buddha happened to notice. He was liberated, and there came the knowledge. When liberated, this is liberation. I had direct knowledge. Birth is exhausted. The holy life has been lived out. What was to be done is done. There's no more of this to come. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness banished and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. That's one description of the Buddha's great night. And then in the Pali canon, that tradition says the first words that came to the Buddha silently were, seeking but not finding the house builder, I travel through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridge pole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unborn nirvana, and reached the end of every kind of craving. That's in the first words in the Theravada. In the Mahayana, we say the first words were, amazing! Now I see that all beings are Buddha nature, fully possess Buddha wisdom and virtue, but because of obscurations, they don't appreciate it. Something like that. And then also, you know, the Pali canon's pretty like, you know, cut to the bone, like straightforward, simple. The Mahayana is much more extensive and flowery. So we have at this time, you might recall the story that the devas said, you know, that were watching the Buddha struggle all along, and like, we need a Buddha in this era. We need somebody to do this, and this guy's getting close here. And they're watching, and then, amazing. Oh my gods. The Buddha realized the way. Time to pour down flowers on the Buddha. And one of the devas said, no, wait! All the times in the past eras when the Buddhas have realized the way, because this is not the first time, it's just the first time in this era. But in the past eras, when the Buddhas attained the way, they gave some sign, you know, to confirm, to make sure that the whole world would know. So let's just wait just a second, see what he does. And the Buddha like rose up 7 yojanas in the sky and radiated light in all directions and declared himself to have realized the complete perfect awakening. And then the deva's like, okay, fellas, drop them. And all the flowers poured everywhere, filling the whole universe with flowers up to the Buddha's knees. As it says in the Lalita Vistara Sutra. So we'll, like any good devas would, today we'll scatter flowers, rain down flowers over the Buddha on his great awakening day. Meanwhile, back in the Shobogenzo. Okay, this is it. Last page. But it's small print. Yes, but before we get to the worms, the undying person in the hut, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. I think such a great Zen teaching. If you wish to know this formless, unlocatable Buddha nature, don't separate from this bag of painful bones and skin, because it's right here. Dogen says, the undying person, whoever they may be, is never at any time separated from their bag of skin. To transgress knowingly, remember this is the dog, why, if the dog has Buddha nature, why does it push into the skin bag? Well, it knowingly and willingly transgresses. To transgress knowingly is not necessarily pushing into a bag of skin. pushing into a bag of skin is not necessarily knowing and willingly transgressing. It has to be willingly transgressing because it is knowing. You should be aware that this deliberate transgression may as such contain concealed within it daily activity that constitutes the emancipated body of suchness. So that we're all, our Buddha nature has all pushed into our skin bags. Here we are. We've knowingly, willingly, happily, compassionately transgressed in the sense of being human, being born this moment as a human. We're willing, aren't we? Right. We don't have a problem being in this skin bag for a while more. Completely willing. Like the wild fox that the Shuso mentioned. Being born 500 times, completely willing. Just wherever our karma takes us, fine. This deliberate transgression coming into a body may as such contain concealed within it daily activity. It does, right? Our daily activity is our body and mind experience, that constitutes the emancipated body of suchness. This is what's meant by pushing into. At the very time the daily activity constituting the emancipated body of suchness is concealed within it, meaning like this knowing or Buddha nature, it's concealed from you and from others as well. But although that's indeed true, do not say you are not yet free of ignorance. So our daily activities are actually the emancipated body of suchness, but this doesn't appear to us. Do not say you are not yet free of ignorance. You leader of donkeys, you horse follower, which notes say is something like a servant, you know, kind of a stable servant, basically a karmic person who's just doing their ordinary work. So you're not yet, don't say you're not yet free of ignorance. This is the emancipated body of suchness, but we have the karmic work of tending donkeys and horses. And that's not all. Eminent priest Yunju said, "You may learn all there is to know about Buddha Dharma, but in doing so you completely falsify the bearing of your mind." Which seems to be implying that studying Dharma like this is basically a mistake. We like disturb our, you know, our original mind in this way. But we do it willingly. This whole class and bunch of talks on the Shobo Genzo here is a huge transgression, but we knowingly and willingly take it up. Hence, even if your partial halfway study of the Buddha Dharma has long been an error for days or even months on end, it still cannot be anything but the dog pushing into such a bag of skin. It's a case of knowingly transgressing. But that itself is no other than being Buddha being. Transgression, transgression. Words, words. Must be Buddha being. Okay, enough about dogs. Let's talk about earthworms. Here's the story. When I first heard this story some years ago, I just thought, I think I laughed, because it's just such a great koan story that Dogen concludes at the end of about 15 stories, his last one, one last investigation of Buddha nature. At an assembly of practitioners under Changsha Qingzhen, Minister Zhu said, "An earthworm is cut into two parts. The two parts move. In which part do you think Buddha nature is found?" Classic. And actually, it's pretty great. And by the time, you know, we're getting to this point of hearing how Dogen's talking about Buddha nature, the very question might seem completely absurd. Which part is the Buddha nature in? But for the classic model of Buddha nature, it's the nature of mind, and it's, you know, it's the nature of each sentient being, their mind, kind of in individual sense, Buddha nature in each sentient being with the mind, right? So if the two parts move, did the mind just split? And if it's the nature of mind, then did the Buddha nature just split too? This is the issue. So maybe some of you know, but I had to Google this about cutting earthworms, what happens there. Because you might have seen, particularly like inchworms, I think I've seen, you know, if they're cut, the two halves inch away. And earthworms, both halves will keep moving. So what's going on there in our modern knowledge of science? It sounds like in those days they thought, well, both halves just become two new worms, right? In ancient China. But apparently earthworms are annelids. Is that right? Annelids?
Yes.
Annelids. And they have a very simple nervous system with one single nerve cord running the length of their body. It's like instead of a brain, it's like one nerve cord. But it's like a lot, very long brain. If cut in two, an annelid can regenerate to some degree, and in some species, there can eventually be two worms. But the common earthworm will only regenerate from the tail end, and the head end always dies. Common earthworm. And I thought, how strange, especially that the tail end is the one. You'd think it'd be the head end. Because that has like the sense or other sense organs. I think they, I don't know if they have eyes, earthworms have eyes, anyone know? This later, the tape flatworms definitely do have eyes. They're sentient beings, they're, you know, quite different from us. They have a nervous system, a very simple one, one single nerve cord. And they can regenerate, and that, you know, we kind of regenerate in some ways, just if you get a cut, it kind of heals itself. It's a miraculous quality of sentient beings. There's a regenerative thing, but they can regenerate a whole body. I thought, well, is there any case of, you know, actually splitting into two beings? Not earthworms, but some species of flatworms. This was another site. Well, I think they start with one head, flatworm. I think they're small and they live in ponds, and they can be cut into many pieces, and each piece will form a complete new worm, each an exact copy of the first. In February 2012, it was reported in England, some scientists created a colony of 20,000 worms, complete worms, all from one original worm, just by cutting it again and again. I don't know if it hurt them or not, but once they were a new body, it was like not an issue, right? It's like, I'm lacking nothing, you know? That was 20,000. In fact, I feel really powerful now because there's 20,000 of me. All from one original, whose bodies and organs do not appear to age. This is a kind of a very strange thing about this kind of flatworm. And may be able to actually live forever if they never caught an infection or other disease. Whereas most sentient beings, their system and bodies naturally age, so even if there weren't if we were in some kind of germ-free environment, there was no infection or disease, eventually the actual just aging of the organs would kill us. But this, apparently, in this article, this unique type of flatworm, it's something about this way it regenerates that the actual, it doesn't seem to age as far as they can find. So they're actually intensively researching these flatworms for use in human studies to maybe increase lifespan of other beings. They're seeing, how does this work? The flatworm has a simple brain-like concentration of nerve cells in its head. So that, I think that's the difference. It's not the whole length of the body, it's in its head, which can be regenerated by stem cells found elsewhere in its body. And there's one strain of flatworm that reproduces without sex simply by splitting itself in half. So without even being cut, it just decides to multiply and reproduce. Amazing, this world of sentient beings. Buddha nature doing its thing, so mysterious. So we don't know what the scientists thought in Tang Dynasty China about how these earthworms work, but it seems like they thought that both halves will just go on living as two different worms. And the story is, Minister Chu said, an earthworm's cut into two parts. The two parts move. In which part do you think Buddha nature is found? Changsha said, have no illusions, or have no false concepts. Chu said, well, what about the movement? Kind of like, don't just say have no illusions. What about this movement, these two parts? And the master said, just undispersed wind and fire, which is the Indian way again of talking about the four elements: earth, wind, fire, and water are what make, give the body life. It's like the way of the life energy of a body. So back at the beginning of this essay, Dogen said, do not think that the wind and fire movements of the conscious mind are Buddha nature. So, which part do you think Buddha nature is found? Have no false concepts, have no illusions. Well, what about the movement? It's just undispersed wind and fire. And undispersed means like that the Buddhist early theory of death is like the four, when we're alive, the four elements are all working in harmony. They're all working together. And death, at death, the four elements disperse back to their natures. You know, the heat element, fire element moves into the world. The earth element becomes dust and ash. The water element of the blood evaporates. And the, what's the other one? Air element in our lungs, well, that's merges with the air of the atmosphere. And then the four element, the dispersed four elements can come back together and make a human body.
So the dispersed elements do not have Buddha nature.
That's interesting too, yeah. It doesn't necessarily say that, but I think the early Indian understanding would be, yeah, dispersed physical elements don't have Buddha nature, but when they come together, and not just four elements, but you get four elements are the form skanda, and then you get these four mind skandas, and you put that all together, a body, mind, organism called a sentient being, Buddha nature is there in and as the sentient being. But Dogen might say that Buddha nature is manifesting as each of the undispersed and dispersed four elements. It's manifesting through every molecule of every bit of everything, we can know.
It's a classic experiment in biology class in college that where you dissect a frog and you can remove the heart and heart tissue just by nature of the heart tissue, as long as you give it its certain elements around it, put it in a certain fluid, it keeps beating. The heart keeps beating. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of the particular part of the tissue.
It doesn't need the brain.
Yeah, so there's no brain, so that's always a classic experiment, because then you're supposed to write about, well, what it's like then.
Interesting.
Cutting off the head, but there's this tissue that's still
And in some ways, it's kind of silly to have researched the scientific thing. It was all about what's going on in the nervous system, what's going on in the brain, the physical brain that makes a sentient being. That's what science talks about, because brain and mind are closely linked. But in old India, they didn't really know or deal with the brain as such. It was all about mind, which is not a physical thing. So in modern times, there's a lot of, I think, really great research going on, trying to investigate, anyway, what's the correlation between the physical brain and mind or consciousness. Even within Buddhism, a lot of these projects, right? And I'm sure it will keep going and we'll learn more and more, although there's maybe some things that will never be answered. So from a kind of physical perspective, it's like, because if mind is connected with brain and Buddha nature is connected with mind, then is the Buddha nature like more connected with the brain? Maybe old Indians would, if they knew about brain science, would say it like that. But again, Dogen, I don't think would go there. You know, it's not limited to any, it's not limited to even what we call sentient beings. Remember, he says sentient beings is inanimate things are sentient beings. And my proposal is that because they're experienced by minds. So mind is a big issue we can't really like get around, but even undispersed wind and fire, like this little oxygen particle, you know, there it is, right? So it must be manifesting Buddha nature. Dogen says, I'll just do some highlight comments. So there's the line, in which part do you think Buddha nature is found? Dogen says, this should be, Buddha nature is cut into two parts. In which part do you think the earthworm is found? Now here is an utterance that must be penetrated with great care. Does the two parts move? In which part do you think the Buddha nature is found? Mean, if both move, they are not worthy to contain Buddha nature? Or does it mean they both move, so it's equally movement? But where in that is the Buddha nature found? Just was breaking down the whole thing and like, why does Buddha nature have to be in a part of a worm or even in the movement? As the more Dogen says, the less we can get a hold of it. Changsha says, have no illusions. The essential meaning of this is what? Thus, it means not having illusions. Therefore, you should penetrate through practice whether this means in the two parts both moving, there is no illusory thought, or this movement is not illusory thinking. Or is it just in the Buddha nature there are no illusory thoughts? So all these parts of the conversation have no illusions, or there are no illusions. Again, it's mu illusions. So you can say, have no illusions, Dogen's kind of reading as there are no illusions. So are there no illusions in the two parts of the worm, in the movement, or in Buddha nature? Or is he simply saying, without reference to the Buddha nature or the two parts, just have no illusions? Dogen says, undispersed wind and fire brings the Buddha nature into manifestation. Undispersed means that have come together as a person, or a worm. Undispersed wind and fire bring the Buddha nature into manifestation. Should we say that the movement is the Buddha nature, or should we say that it's wind and fire, or five skandhas, or karmic consciousness? We must not say that Buddha nature and wind and fire appear together. We could say appear together as two things. Buddha nature, if we say Buddha nature and wind and fire appear together, together implies they're two things, right? They must be one. Buddha nature as wind and fire. We must not say that one appears while the other does not. Buddha nature, wind and fire. Nor can we say that wind and fire are in and of themselves Buddha nature. So he's basically eliminated all possible relationships between wind and fire and Buddha nature. Again, we don't say that Buddha nature and wind and fire appear together, and don't say that one appears and the other doesn't, and don't say that wind and fire are in and of themselves Buddha nature. So that's all. There's no other relationships between wind and fire and Buddha nature. Or we could even say between karmic consciousness and Buddha nature. There's no relationship between them of difference or sameness. Therefore, Changsha does not say there is a Buddha nature in the earthworm or that earthworms have no Buddha nature. He just says, undispersed wind and fire, the living actuality of Buddha nature must be construed from Changsha's utterance. You must quietly concentrate your efforts on the words undispersed wind and fire. What's the ruling principle of undispersed? Does undispersed refer to accumulations of wind and fire that have not yet reached the stage where they must disintegrate and scatter? It could hardly mean that. Wind and fire undispersed is Buddha expounding Dharma. Undispersed wind and fire is Dharma expounding Buddha. That is to say, it's the arrival of the time of one sound preaching Dharma. One sound preaching Dharma is the arrival of the time. The Dharma is one sound because it's the one sound Dharma. Moreover, to think the Buddha nature exists only for the duration of life and cannot exist in death betrays an extremely feeble understanding. The time of life is being Buddha nature, no Buddha nature. The time of death is being Buddha nature, no Buddha nature. If there's a question about dispersal or non-dispersal of wind and fire, it can only be about the dispersal or non-dispersal of Buddha nature. Even the time of dispersal must be Buddha nature being Buddha nature mu. Even the time of non-dispersal must be being Buddha nature, no Buddha nature. Hence, to cling to the mistaken view that the presence of Buddha nature depends on whether or not there's movement, that its spiritual working depends on whether or not there's consciousness, or that it's inherent or not in being perceived to be so, that's not Buddhism.
We can read that again.
Yeah. Hence, to cling to the mistaken view that the presence of Buddha nature, these are mistaken views, the presence of Buddha nature depends on whether or not there's movement, that its spiritual working, the spiritual working of Buddha nature depends on whether or not there's consciousness. Oh, take that one away. It's so sad. Or that it's inherent or not in being perceived to be so as Buddha nature. All those views are not Buddhism. Yes.
Yeah.
Tell the big guy.
I will.
Let him get to the end and then you can object.
What's your objection?
My objection is there's a principle in philosophy called self-referential inconsistency, and that means what you're saying, what you're doing, what you're saying. Do as I say, not as I do. And everything you listed there is not Buddhism, is exactly what he is doing.
Let's get to the punchline.
Okay. He can do what he wants, and I don't mind Dogen saying whatever he wants. Go ahead. Say a little more if you want, Dogen. Okay. For infinite kalpas past, foolish people in great number have regarded the conscious mind as Buddha nature. It's kind of going back to the very beginning. He kind of brought up that point. And we might think, can't we just say this very mind is Buddha nature? This conscious, discriminating mind, that's what conscious mind means, dualistic consciousness. The consciousness mind as Buddha nature. They have regarded it as the original person. How laughably absurd. In making further utterances about Buddha nature, and this won't, by the way, be a case of entering the water and getting covered with mud, which is a Zen phrase for, like, getting all messy by, like, trying to help people with lots of Dharma teachings. Like, this feels very muddy right now. But Dogen's going to say, like, this last part is not going to be a case of entering the water and getting all muddy. Just be really straightforward here. Buddha nature is a fence, a wall, a tile, a pebble. Okay. That's the punchline. Or we could say, when making an utterance beyond this, you can only say, what is Buddha nature?
Right.
Do you fully understand? Three heads, eight arms. The end.
Is what got more than one radical in it?
Well, that one, the second one is what? Yeah, I'm not sure what the right part is, but the left part means person. Maybe people are the ones who ask what. Three heads and six arms. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12. 12 heads and 24 arms. Finally, just a final word from Shogaku Shunryu Suzuki Roshi on December 8, 1966, the day of Rohatsu. I don't know if it was a sesshin or not, but he was giving a talk. I'm very glad to be here on the day when the Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. When he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he said, "It's wonderful to see Buddha nature in everything and in each individual." What he meant was, when we practice Zazen, we all have Buddha nature, and we are all Buddha himself. By practice, he didn't mean to just sit under the Bodhi tree, or to sit in a cross-legged posture. Our cross-legged posture is the basic posture. Most fundamental way of being here. But what he meant actually was that mountain and trees And flowing water and flowers and plants and everything as they are is the way Buddha is. It means everything is taking Buddha's activity in each position and in each way. But the way they are for themselves is not understood by themselves in the realm of consciousness. They're being that way, but it's not understood in the realm of consciousness. What we see or what we hear is just a part of our limited idea of how we are. But when we just sit, we are being our conception. And you know, in 1966, he was still working with English. I think his English is pretty good, but it seemed like a funny sentence. Did he really mean that? When we just sit, we are being our conception. I don't know. It's an unusual and kind of subtle sentence. I thought, maybe he did mean it just like that. And I thought, that's great. When we just sit, we're just being our conception. We're not like using our conception to know our sitting. We're just being conception itself. At least, I like imagining that that's what he meant. With my conception. In other words, when we practice something, like when we sit here, there is Buddha's way or Buddha nature. So when we ask, what is Buddha nature? Buddha nature will vanish. But when we just practice Zazen like this, we have full understanding of Buddha nature. The only way to obtain Buddha nature or understand Buddha nature is just practice Zazen, or just to be here in this way. So what he meant by finding Buddha nature was to be there as he was, beyond the realm of consciousness, the Buddha. So it may be said we originally have Buddha nature before we practice Zazen, before we acknowledge it in terms of consciousness. So in this sense, whatever we do, that's Buddha's activity. So if you want to understand it, you cannot understand it. When you give up understanding it, true understanding is there always. Usually after Zazen, I talk for you, but why you come here is not to just listen to my talk, but to practice Zazen. This point should be always remembered by us. Why I talk in this way is just to encourage us to practice true Zazen. So we say, although we have Buddha nature, if you don't practice it, in other words, if you try to understand it some other way, you do not understand it. But just when you practice it, you will understand what is our way.
No objection.
Do you understand? So tonight we'll bring up another old story about Bodhidharma meeting Emperor Wu. And Emperor asked him, who are you anyway? And Bodhidharma said, I don't know. Which kind of, interestingly, at least to me, in Chinese, the way of writing don't know is literally not consciousness. They use the character that translates vijñāna also to mean no. There's other characters for no, but I don't know why that one was chosen there, but and nobody ever translates it that way. But you could translate literally as, who are you facing me? Not consciousness. Not vijñāna. And we can all ask, or she so, a question. About what it is. What is it? So now we have some time to forget all about understanding Buddha nature and just sit a little bit more. The best periods of the whole sesshin are coming soon. Ah, so sweet. It's like nothing left to do, and it's not over yet, and we can just, with no regrets, no anticipation, no disappointment, no elation, no judgment, one way or another, just be here for all beings. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.